Consider the following, and some of the results you will hardly believe.
Hi, this is Elliot Gavin Keenan. I almost, kind of, sort of have a PhD in psychology from UCLA. Well, human development in psychology.
Isn't it easier to just say that you're a candidate? A PhD candidate? Isn't that the official?
I feel like I've transcended candidacy at this point. And you are?
I'm Ava Gerba. I'm a master's student in neuroscience.
And we are going to go over some very interesting stuff today. Today we're going to be talking about the DSM, how different types of psychologists feel about the DSM, some of the alternative approaches that are being tried out to augment or replace the DSM, and we're also going to bookend with some questions that we pulled from Quora.com, which is a wild ride. And sometimes we will answer the questions, and sometimes we'll just read the existing answers. For the first question, I would like Ava to read the question, please.
Can you disappoint your psychologist or therapist?
And this answer is from David McPhee, has a PhD in psychology. And he says, oh yeah, you certainly can. It's 9:50 a.m. My 9 a.m. person has left. You're scheduled for 10 a.m. I start thinking about you. I generate caring curiosity about you and your life and your therapy work and fresh eagerness to know what you'll bring to the session today. I send a few blessings your way. I finish my warm-up at about 9:59 and walk out to the waiting room to get you. You're not there. Maybe you're not going to show up at all. I go back to my office and sit there doing my best to sustain that unconditional positive regard and warm care and compassionate curiosity, and honestly, I am fighting disappointment. I may even notice a twinge of anger I have to address and deal with. At about 10:20, it becomes apparent you're not going to appear. I consider you may have had an accident or something worse, and now I deal with that bit of fear and worry. By 10:25, I've let go of it. I write NSNM, no show, no message. I go get coffee. Colleague says, no show. I nod. Colleague says, sorry. I chuckle and say, I was really ready for this guy. Take my coffee to my office and start my warm-up for the next person. Point. If you show up, both figuratively and literally, it's almost impossible to disappoint me. Together we can deal with anything, including your slips, your crappy week, your skipping your med check, your anger with me, all of it. You have no responsibility to make me happy. None. But since you asked, that's how patients disappoint me. Now we're going to try to answer a question. And again, I will turn it to Ava to start us off. Ava, can you please read this question?
Why is there such a huge difference in the criteria for autism, with autistic people claiming the main symptoms are sensory overload and masking, and scientists claiming interaction abnormalities and ritualistic behaviors to be the main symptoms?
Well, I would say autistic community, particularly the online community, different priorities than the scientific community, and they have come to different conclusions. Now, I don't necessarily think that autistic people think that masking is, like, a core criteria of autism, but it is something they talk about a lot,
I think one of the important things to recognize here, right, is what are people's experiences with autism? autistic people are often describing, right, their internal experiences. And so they're not seeing the external experiences that clinicians are describing to be the problem. They're seeing more what's happening internally with them. And to often to their point, that is what they struggle with, right? I don't think most autistic people would say masking is a core criteria of autism. Most autistic people recognize that masking is a reason why autistic people don't seem autistic in certain environments. Particularly, right, Elliot, we're talking about individuals who have a great capacity for communication in one or more ways, and average to above average IQs.
Yeah, so obviously they're talking about masking a lot because that's something you see in that group of people. But it doesn't mean that all autistic people experience masking. I, for one, don't really think that I do most of the time. And we found out the other day that I have a really low CAT Q score.
Camouflaging Autistic Traits Questionnaire.
Yeah, my score was like an 80, which is like half of the average for autistic people.
Well, we talked about this, right? This, you might have grown up in an environment that was more accepting of your traits within your family and your home. And so you might not have more of the urge to mask other than other autistic people. I think the important thing with this question, right, is that it's, you have these two kind of, it's kind of chicken and egg, right? You have the internal experiences and the external experiences. And autistic people want the diagnostic criteria to be more reflective of their internal experiences. Because to them, those are the things that they struggle with. Not the things that clinicians are externally seeing and pointing out as characteristics.
Which is a great segue to our next topic. Now we're going to talk about a paper. And this paper was published in Professional Psychology Research and Practice. The title of the paper is Psychologist Attitudes Towards DSM-5 and Its Alternatives, and it's by Raskin et al. Jonathan D. Raskin.
Elliot, what I find really interesting looking just at the author's list, because I took a look at it, if you, the very first paragraph or so, just gives you a description of who the authors are. And it's really interesting to me because the authors encompass an experimental psychologist, a clinical, a counseling psychologist, and I don't know, I forget the third guy. The third guy has a PhD in industrial and organizational psychology. So I find it really interesting just the group of researchers who are examining this problem because it's mainly coming right from, like, a clinical perspective. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. So this paper has to do with the DSM. It's an acronym. It stands for Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. It's currently in its fifth edition, which was published in 2013. And it's getting a text revision, which I think has come out already.
Yeah, it came out in March of this year. Very small text revision.
People call it, or sort of the cliche about it, is that it's the Bible of American psychiatry. And what it is, it's a categorical system to classify mental illness. Probably because of its reputation as a Bible, people, like lay people who are not psychologists,
or psychiatrists,
tend to believe that the DSM is very important. That it informs treatment decisions rigidly, and that it is the word of law, like the Torah. I guess that's why they call it a Bible, huh? Is it because it's like the Okay.
It's and, like either of them.
What I've told people online and gotten into multiple fights about is that I say it's actually a directory of insurance billing codes to bill your third-party insurance.
Can I add something?
Yes, but let me just say, this makes people very angry.
Yeah, I just wanted to add to Elliot's point, you know, I don't think, you know, while it's this very detailed and specific document for psychologists and psychiatrists to use to make diagnoses, it's not like they sit in their offices, see patient or client by client, right, and are reading just from the DSM. Like, you walk into the office and they're reading the DSM, and they're like, Elliot, yes, you have bipolar 1. And that is going to tell us everything we need to know about you and how to make you better. And I think people often think that that's the way the DSM works and the way psychologists and psychiatrists maybe come to use that text.
Yeah, but the study found that in reality, when they asked psychologists who they recruited from APA listservs, Ava?
Yeah, they sent 9,625 emails across various APA. In this case, it's the American Psychological Association. There's another APA, the American Psychiatric
Association. Which is in charge of the DSM.
Interestingly, Elliot, they do mention in the paper that research and psychiatrists say that they love the DSM, but that makes sense because it's they're the medical doctor side of the field. So they sent roughly over 9,000 emails across APA listservs to psychologists, and they specifically targeted lists or groups of psychologists that are oriented towards clinical practice, and so work with patients and therefore likely have higher exposure and training with the DSM. With all the people that did this, they distributed it on a quantitative online survey, just to, in case I didn't say that, to the psychologists. And basically they did their analysis on a few hundred psychologists across several domains. Importantly, though, again, these are psychologists within clinical domains, and they needed to be, they only included people who had licenses and completed 75% of the survey. So the they included several categories, and they kind of grouped similar orientations together. This included cognitive behavioral psychologists, which included CBT, people who practice CBT, and other forms of behavioral therapy. They had psychodynamic therapists that included, or psychologists that included psychodynamic and interpersonal. You had a third category, the smallest category, but I think the most broad, of humanistic constructivist and system psychologists, which had a number of different practices in there. And then you had the last group, which was integrative and eclectic psychologists, which are trained in a variety, a kind of a mix of different clinical orientations.
And overall, across disciplines, psychologists responded they did use the DSM at least once a month. Most of them said that they did. I think 86%. And they said that their primary reason for using the DSM was third-party billing.
Which
we can take to be, you know, billing of insurance companies.
And they also, there was a secondary major reason. The first one was third-party the first one was third-party billing, but the second one was differentiating psychological diagnosis. So just referring to it to make psychological diagnosis based on codes and being able to differentiate between codes. Importantly, though, Elliot, while they clearly said that they refer to the DSM, almost 90% of them reported being dissatisfied with the document. Which is...
Yes, because in the study, they identified, you know, the capacity for insurance billing as one of the strengths of the DSM, and they identified weaknesses, the weaknesses being obscuring individual differences and over-medicalization of psychosocial problems, which is something we'll get to in a little bit. So, do psychologists like the DSM? Most of them said that they didn't like it. But they did mostly say that they supported scientific alternatives to the DSM. The interesting thing, though, is that most of them had no awareness of the alternatives that are currently being developed. Ava, can you tell us about the alternatives that are currently being developed?
Yeah, and that were included in this study surveyed on. The first one, there were a number of them across, and they did a good job in this study of selecting alternatives that fit a range of the clinical and psychological orientations being surveyed in the study. So the first one that they included is actually the most similar to the DSM. It's the ICD, or the International Classification of Diseases, which was produced by the WHO and basically serves as like the DSM for the rest of the world outside North America. It's very, very mirrored to the DSM, at least in terms of psychological, psychiatric disorders present in the DSM. And that was the one that most psychologists were familiar with. However, they included a number of more specific, I think, alternatives. They had two psychodynamic alternatives. They had the Psychodynamic Diagnostic Manual, the PDM, and they had the Operationalized Psychodynamic Procedure, I think it is. It's the OPD. And those measures are really, really, those systems are really, really geared towards psychodynamic psychologists, and it's really interesting because at least the PDM specifically was designed to be a supplement to the DSM, not a replacement. So you have the ICD, the PDM, the OPD, then you had two systems that are currently being really, really examined in research. You have the RDoC, Elliot. The RDoC stands for what? It's the Research Domain.
Research Domains of Criteria thing.
Yeah, which is developed by the National Institutes of Mental Health in the U.S. and is really looking at combining a lot of the etiological research coming out of neurobiology with psychological constructs and looking at different domains of development and how all of it fits together across a dimension. You have also HITOP, which is the Hierarchical Taxonomy of Psychopathology.
Yep.
And that is similar to the RDoC. It's much more common in research. It's both the RDoC and HITOP are very new, and such they've only been around for like
HITOP is a lot newer than RDoC, though.
Yeah. But they've both only been around for the last 10 to 15 years, if
HITOP's
that.
HITOP's been around for like 2 years.
3 years. I think it was 2018. But
there was a pandemic.
The HITOP, like the RDoC, is very popular currently in research domains, And it really looks to build this dimensional construct of psychological conditions across dimensions, mainly in contrast to the Ardok via psychological constructs, and in particularly it relies heavily on personality research. Would that be right, Elliot? I know you know way more about High Top than I do.
Yeah.
And then the last alternative, was the power threat meaning framework, which is kind of a system. It's a system developed in the UK. It was interestingly funded by the Department of Clinical Psychology, and is endorsed by the British Psychological Association. And it's the only framework here co-built by people with psychological conditions, along with psychologists. And it really throws away traditional constructs in nosology, and throws away the idea of really diagnosis, and really tries to get at the systematic and environmental things that might be happening, and how people can build narratives around their experiences.
So those were the alternatives that they presented to the psychologists, and a lot of people were just like, I don't know, man. Like, I've never really seen it before.
Except for the ICD. Most people.
Except for the ICD. So, it looks like we may be stuck with the DSM unless we switch to the ICD.
And they were.
Which makes sense because they have the same purpose. But the reality is, in my opinion, most of these people are just going by clinical judgment most of the time. And they're looking up numbers in the book. And maybe they pull it out once a month because they're assigning a number they don't usually give people.
Well, and the reasoning, Elliot, we talked about is payment, right? They have to be paid. And if our system of healthcare relies on insurance billing, they really have no choice.
Yeah. Another thing this study asked was whether psychologists considered mental health disorders to be a subset of medical disorders. Basically, whether mental illness is a medical disease. And except for the CBT clinicians, who were neutral, all of the psychologists said they didn't think that this was the case. It seems kind of controversial to me, because we're talking about some things that are so inextricable from the biology and the genetics and, you know, the neuroinflammation and all of it, like bipolar disorder. It seems clear to me that it should be considered a medical condition, but apparently most psychologists don't really feel that way.
It's funny, Elliot, because we just talked about the alternatives, right? And the one alternative that I think is really aligned with that statement is the RDoC. But they're not familiar with the RDoC. The RDoC really tries to take those pieces of medical information.
I think, you know, they asked, you know, about abandoning the medical model and whether that would be a good idea or a bad idea. And I think there's some real-world implications to abandoning the medical model. Like, I have been in behavioral health facilities where patients that I was, you know, hanging around with went into a reaction called neuroleptic malignant syndrome that can be fatal. And they had to call the paramedics and take him to a medical hospital. I strongly believe that if we are medically intervening, like we are giving someone for the first time neuroleptic or typical antipsychotics, like Haldol, then they should be in a medical hospital because they are receiving a medical intervention. They should not be in a behavioral health facility that does not have medical capabilities. And whether or not we buy into the medical model does affect, you know, what people will consider is an acceptable place to put a mental health patient. Plus, it's easy to mistake encephalitis or delirium of medical origin with a mental illness, and people are biased and will often say that it's a mental illness before they'll say, oh, maybe we should see if this person has anti-NMDA receptor encephalitis. So,
I think, Elliot, it's important to also recognize something else that was in that section of results. Because they also, while they asked psychologists in this study whether they believed mental disorders were a class of medical disorders, and most of them disagreed, they also asked them then if they thought the DSM labels for mental conditions were the result of non-medical issues of living. And most of them disagreed. Most of the orientations disagreed. With the exception of the humanistic constructionist systems psychologists. And I think that's important to note, because most of them are still not saying then it's a social problem. It's entirely a social problem. To me, what this really points to is that they're saying that it falls somewhere in between. And so I think it's important to recognize that. I also think the other thing about a lot, they also reported that they didn't feel though that the DSM was hindering their autonomy as psychologists or their diagnosis. So it's really interesting, right? Because it points out the billing thing again. If it's not hindering their autonomy or their things, they're using it, but they're not using it as a way to entirely engulf their practice.
So in reality, psychologists do not treat the DSM-5 as their Bible.
They don't treat it as their Bible. And I think this has important implications, right, Elliot, as we train, right? Clearly they're not familiar with the alternatives, right? And maybe that points to lapses in training and education that we need to have, right? Because it cannot, maybe, you know, psychology doesn't have to be this unilateral religion, right? It could be this multifaceted religious system, right? You can step into a church and a mosque and it'd be okay.
It's copacetic. Alright, well, that's it for today. Thanks everyone for listening. Like and subscribe, and have a good one.